I walked towards the place where the light seemed to be coming from, with a slow but determined step, without leaving the path, although I soon realized that the light was coming from inside the grove. It took me a little more than a minute to reach the edge of a meadow, which was where the light was coming from, and from there I began to make out the silhouette of an enormous spaceship, about 50 to 75 meters wide. The light came from the top and the bottom of the ship. So I jumped from the path into the meadow and remained enchanted for a few seconds. As the two wide beams of light slowly faded, I heard a voice in correct Spanish, with a sing-song, somewhat musical tone that said to me, "Don't be afraid. Come closer. Please." Then, as naturally as I could, I approached the ship, whose base was now illuminated by a powerful white and pink light source, which came out through an open door in its underbelly, from which a kind of ramp soon emerged. I headed towards it, and as soon as I reached the bottom of the ladder I stopped and looked up, perceiving at the door a tall body shape, surrounded by a kind of multicolored halo. Immediately I heard the voice again, "Don't be afraid. Come aboard our ship, we wish to speak with you." The mechanical ramp took me up to the top, to the door, which was situated about 4 or 5 meters from the ground. Before that I had been able to see that the ship was resting on four legs, which seemed to be tubular with articulated joints. From what I could see, the ship was a rather dark metallic color. As I crossed the entrance the voice said to me, "Welcome aboard the ship Light of the Cosmos," and with a gentle gesture, of the three who were waiting for me, the one closest to me who later turned out to be a woman indicated some seats in the center of that immense room, placed around an oval-shaped table. The first impression I had, which struck me, in view of the whiteness of it all, was that it was a plastic apparatus. Now, seeing them move beside me, I could already speak of human bodies, since, at least, they had a torso, a head, two arms and two legs. They were dressed in a kind of white jumpsuit, very tight to the body, and shod in boots also white that seemed to be made of canvas. I never observed the slightest wrinkle or crease in their attire. On their chests, at the level of their hearts, they wore an emblem in the center of which was a circle, a shining, multicolored, multi-prism eye, which never stopped flashing for a single instant, and on which my gaze would often remain fixed. In the distance, about 6 or 7 meters away, at the back of the room, to my right, I saw four more crew members moving around in front of a large screen, on which little lights of all colors kept going on and off, as if they were manipulating buttons on that huge control panel that was at the foot of the luminous screen. Later, one of them joined us at the table, around which we had already been sitting silently for a long time. When they sat down, they had become motionless, like statues. I won't say that they were looking at me, they were 2 or 3 meters away, because the halo prevented me from seeing their eyes, which I would later discover. I could barely see the outline of their face, since they were wearing a small helmet. It was undoubtedly a stage of acclimatization. I felt it as if they had been telling me, "Be assured that here, among us, you will feel at home." And to do this, naturally, the best way was to let myself be watched, and to observe and try to capture everything around me. One of the things that struck me most was the silence that reigned in the room. From time to time I fixed my gaze on the four crew members who were busy in front of the large luminous screen. They moved and gestured. This would be the general tone of all the crew members while I lived with them, slowly. They seemed like characters in a film projected in slow motion. I also looked very closely at the table in front of me. And, as earthly pride was still a must, at all times I tried to compare what I saw with what could be its equivalent on Earth. The table looked like those we see in radio studios, with several handles, and from the center emerged some retractable screens, on one of which I could admire several documentaries that dealt with, among other things, their travels, the receptions that the populations of the planets they visited had reserved for them, popular festivals, mini saucer dives into the seas, and several other episodes, most of the time with extraterrestrial people and other times with Earthlings as the main protagonists. I also counted several doors that I did not see open even once. Behind me, at the foot of the wall, there was a kind of semicircular console, with a table of the same shape and half a meter high. There were 10 little armchairs similar to mine. Perhaps half an hour passed like this. I can't say exactly, because I felt like I had lost track of time. Now, every time I think about it, I think it was because I felt very comfortable, even though everything around me had something mysterious and fantastic at the same time. Maybe because I had a premonition of what I was going to discover on board that extraterrestrial spaceship. When I stopped my visual inspection, I stared at them. And although I couldn't decipher what expression dominated their faces, I felt their gazes on me very well. After a while, I heard the voice again, "Would you be willing to take a message from us for the inhabitants of Earth?" I answered affirmatively without thinking twice. And I added, "Now, if you'll allow me, I'll go to the car to get some paper and my pen." "No, it's not necessary. We will engrave the message in your mind. If you agree to it, of course." I told them that I didn't see the slightest problem. A few minutes of silence passed, but I realized that they were talking to each other, the three crew members and the fourth, who had just joined us and who was always standing, leaning on the back of the center chair. I observed how they tilted their heads, as if looking at each other, but I didn't hear any noise, not even the slightest voice. Then the newcomer approached me. I saw that she was a woman because of the shape of her body and her long reddish-brown hair, which I discovered through the multicolored halo as she came so close to me and placed a helmet on me that was shaped like a rabbi's cap. The first words I heard through the helmet's headphones were these: "We don't think you're in any serious danger, but the strong impressions that your mind is going to be subjected to could cause you some complications. If you agree to take that small risk, don't move. But if not, you can take off your helmet yourself, get out of our ship, get back in the car and continue your journey in peace." I stood still. I thought that I had faced so many dangers throughout my life, and sometimes, possibly, for reasons much less important than that one. On the other hand, why deny it? Such a situation amused me and, with each passing minute, my curiosity to know how it would all turn out just increased. The truth is that I could not call curiosity the feeling that had gripped me from the moment I discovered the flying saucer parked in that meadow. And if it is true that they compressed many images into my mind, it is no less true that, before they put the helmet on me, I was already very worried about seeing how I would manage to retain in my mind everything I was seeing and what it was not difficult to sense that I still had to see. Knowing the skepticism and distrust that most people tend to display when faced with any unusual event, I am convinced that my desire to retain those fantastic experiences in my mind was focused on my later personal recall and, perhaps, to share them with a good friend of mine. 1. Let me explain, who has known countless disappointments and setbacks, dealing with more tangible matters, to harbor too many hopes regarding the ability of my countrymen on Earth to strive to understand others and, even less, to be willing to draw from our personal experiences healthy lessons for everyone. So, in this unusual situation, one cannot pretend anything else, let me warn you, than to narrate, as plainly as possible, what one saw, what one heard, and the memories and reflections that are long, pleasant and even amusing conversation aroused in me, and nothing more, but to thank the reader friend for the attention paid to my story. And I must stress that I will do my best to ensure that these pages, despite everything, exude optimism. Point on the Prats de Molo Camprodon Highway where I turned off on August 31, 1981, shortly before 9 o'clock at night, towards the Alta Vals per Forest Road. Entrance to the Forest Road. Just as you enter, on the right, you can see a couple of dozen metal beehives. A long conversation and its long silences. It is of no use to achieve security, in relation to men, if celestial things and subterranean things and everything in the limitless universe continues to be the object of confused ideas. Lucretius. In this age of moral poverty, The fundamental thing is to awaken enthusiasm, Picasso. You have to love life to love space. Kazuaki Tuasaki. On board a spaceship from another world, suddenly a voice said to me, "We have already entrusted you with the message." That sounds more like an ultimatum to me, I ventured. It is both at the same time, and we are very sorry to have been forced to write it in those terms. At the moment I could not locate where that voice came from. It seemed to me that it came from the top of the room and at times that it came from the center of the table that separated me from them. During the recording of the message, which they did with some slowness, I had been able to read it perfectly and I must confess that its content alarmed me greatly. But one, who rarely loses his optimism, he may have something of that cosmic fluid that, according to them, some earthlings possess, would end up calming down when thinking that, by spreading the message, he might contribute to avoiding worse evils. "What do you want us to talk about?" asked the voice. Many questions were running through my head and now that I could give vent to them seemed as if, as they struggled to get out all at once, none of them managed to detach themselves from the tumult. That is why I remained silent for a few minutes. I want to make a caveat, when I speak of time, moments, minutes, etc., I always do so by approximation and with a time span, the 7 hours I estimate to have spent in their company, as a point of reference, because the truth is and I am still aware of this even now that there, in his ship, I lost not only the notion of time but even that of my geographical location. I mean, that although when I boarded that spaceship it was anchored to planet Earth, while I was there I had the sensation of finding myself in a world very different from my own, among people whose mental configuration had very little to do with the one that usually dominates on Earth. The truth is that I wanted to ask them many things and I didn't know where to start. At last I began, "I would like to know where you come from, if there are many inhabited planets besides yours, how you have organized your lives and, above all, how you have managed to overcome death, and other things that I will remember later." The voice, always sweet and sing-song, answered, "If you are referring to the last planet we visited before arriving on Earth, we will tell you that it is known as the Bright Green, so called because it is full of rivers and lakes. We come from different planets. Four of us are from the Ivory White planet, two are from Violet Flower and the other is precisely from Bright Green. And it is very possible that none of us will ever set foot on our home planet again. Although if there are reasons for that we can be in communication with them at any time and by various means. So you will never see your families again? Families, as you understand them, do not exist in our world. We live in a community regime on an interplanetary scale. Which means that when we are born we become part of the community to which our parents belong, until our experiences take us to other places, but without being tied to anyone in particular and to everyone at the same time. Do you understand?" The truth is that I did not quite understand it, because it is always difficult to get rid of earthly traditions and atavisms and to have our minds completely available to assimilate the unusual. Even, as I have been able to verify a priori and a posteriori, when it comes to people who consider themselves, or boast, to be progressive and who, faced with facts that go beyond the framework of their routine doctrinal ramblings, react like authentic retrogrades. "There are many inhabited planets," the voice continued. "Each one of them with unique characteristics, which are what give it its name. As you would say, there are richer ones and there are poorer ones. One of them, for example, is the so-called Golden Desert, which we visited not long ago. If we were to look only at its surface, it is rather poor looking, like your Sahara Desert, but inside we can discover immense lakes whose waters have great sedative powers. That is why it has very few inhabitants. But there, in addition to having several observatories and many reference points for our navigation, they have set up spas for the people of our community. But all that, on a planetary scale, would require a monstrous organization," I interjected. "Nothing monstrous, comrade. Just a rational organization, in permanent readjustment and improvement, in which any member of our great community never feels like a stranger. Let us give you another example, since everyone knows that they can and should collaborate in the improvement of our respective existences. Let us take the case of one of our comrades who is entrusted with the control of the health of one of these lakes. That he will be very attentive to his mission is unquestionable, but also that if he notices the slightest anomaly anywhere else, he will immediately activate the alert device, because he knows very well, as he has been taught at school, that nothing that happens around him can be foreign to him. And he also knows that nothing should be underestimated, no matter how slight its abnormality may be, and that, therefore, you must do everything in your power to return everything to normal. Do you understand? Naturally, I understood, since, as I was able to verify, they used perfect Spanish. Another direct witness spoke of chemically pure Spanish. The thing is that, at first glance, it was hard for me to believe all this, to be honest. Then I thought that, given the resources that we Earthlings have, we could perfectly set up such an organization on a planetary scale. On condition, of course, that we had first corrected the tremendous and insulting social injustices that exist on Earth, and let's not even talk about if the Earth were to join a cosmic community. But I was still obsessed by what seemed to be the basis of such an organization. And so I put it to them. First stretch of the forest road, which I drove slowly, despite it being private land of the state and no entry allowed. Point on the road where my car stopped and my headlights went out. Human communities without a family base, as we have already told you, the voice continued, the basic cells of our communities are the groups formed by affinity of experiences. You would surely say by professional or family obligations. We will give you another example, before coming to Earth to carry out the double mission of exploring your planet and monitoring it, we piloted a much smaller ship than this one, dedicated to interstellar exploration. And now, when we return from this mission, it is quite possible that our crew will be disbanded, at least for a certain period of time. One of our companions is pregnant, which means that she will be cared for in the next level 1 planet that we visit, until the day of delivery. It is possible that one day she will join us again. The mere fact that we have been fellow travelers during some mission could explain why we are interested in the evolution of her condition. And, after a brief silence, the voice continued, one of our companions will join another of our crewmates, which means that, at the first place we land, they will separate from us and will have time to live or travel as they please through space, visiting those planets that please them, with the certainty that they will be received everywhere as true brothers. Do you understand? I understood it, of course I understood it, but my complicated Earthling mind kept splashing those beautiful pictures with insolent questions, which I asked myself, but how can communities of any kind be formed without family ties? And do they get married when they want, without asking anyone's permission, and then get married when they feel like it, and that's it? And how long do these honeymoons last? And who sets the duration of the trip? And do they go on a trip through space, just like that, without anyone marking out an itinerary for them? A universal fraternity, although the truth is that a libertarian should not have been surprised by anything he was hearing, since the fraternal society that we always dreamed of, and for which we have fought so hard, had as its motto, from each according to his abilities and to each according to his needs. Which means that, at an early stage of this evolution towards universal brotherhood, an important detail, people with little or no culture were already talking about universal brotherhood, those who, for whatever reason, have a greater capacity for understanding, for organization, for work and for understanding human problems, should put this creative power at the service of everyone. While those who are less well endowed, or less well endowed, which they are, almost always, because of age-old social injustices, should be able to access everything that allows them to be happy, free and, naturally, to overcome their primary impotence with the same ease as those who are better endowed. I already know this, because the wise men and the cretins repeat it to us daily, in unison, although with different arguments, is the great utopia. But it is curious that these days, while I was typing the original of this book, in a very popular Spanish television broadcast, one of the characters who was supposed to come from another world was made to say, "I come from a place where he who has, gives, and he who has not, takes." Perhaps because I had been able to see how difficult it would be to carry out this revolution on Earth, it was now so difficult for me to admit that, on another planet, such a society could be a reality. What I had no doubt about, however, was that as I talked with them, an immense happiness took hold of me. A happiness very different from any I have ever experienced in my life. But, nevertheless, I still stood my ground. I understand it, and at the same time I don't quite understand it, to be honest, because if two beings get together, that means they're going to form a family. Not at all, my friend, because it's possible that one of the two, on that trip, decides to stay, for whatever reason, on the planet where they're spending, to put it in your words, the honeymoon. But on the other hand, if when a couple procreates, both, or one of the two, wishes to be assigned to the planet where the child is being formed, that assignment will be given without delay. Because the community must always respect the intimate desires of the person, as long as he or she knows how to harmonize his or her desires with his or her work. Do you understand now? Not completely, because, as I see, in your world there reigns such individual freedom that I can't conceive how even minimal obligations towards the community can be fulfilled. Because the individual must have some obligation towards the community. Or not? Of course he or she does. But it is not an obligation, as you Earthlings understand it, but a personal experience that is guided, at a given moment, by what we could call the planning of the universal community. And who manages that planning? I interrupted. Well, in reality it is a network of computer coordinators. We would call that robotic bureaucracy. I interrupted again, with a hint of insolence, of which, in truth, I was immediately ashamed. Something really frightening to imagine, I added. At least for freedom-loving Earthlings, I confess that I fell once again, and it would not be the last into one of our many set phrases. Because if at that moment they had asked me what kind of freedom I was referring to, they would have certainly put me in a difficult position, since we progressives have fallen into the trap that the retrogrades have set for us, that of referring to freedom, and so many other things, always in abstract terms. When what we should always be talking about is the fundamental, concrete freedoms of the human person, which, together, form freedom, as they would later point out to me. That would be true if only the chosen or the privileged were in charge, but we have neither one nor the other. Here, all of us, without exception, are in a position to pass through the control panels of the coordinators, since it is something that we learn from a very young age in school. It should also be noted that we never put anything into action, however attractive or seductive the project may seem to us, without it being provided with its respective elements of control and neutralization and, if necessary, self-destruction. Elements that are of a human impulse in all cases. No mechanism can escape our control, however harmless it may seem. We have humanized technology. Do you understand now? Yes. But at every step we take, I am faced with new questions. For example, how do you organize the education of children? And does this kind of free love that you apparently practice never cause friction or confrontation? The education of children. And free love, your reaction does not surprise us in the least, because you do not know the kind of education that our boys and girls receive from an early age. As soon as they begin to have the use of reason, from the age of 4 or 5. Without the slightest discrimination, boys and girls receive a double education, vocational and necessary. Often both coincide, but the essential thing, the key, is that every boy and girl knows from a very young age that the necessary education is what will place them in a place of service to the community tomorrow. Meanwhile, with their vocational education, they will fill what you call leisure time. Although it is worth pointing out that, given their general education, These times, in addition to promoting and developing the blossoming of their full personality, in harmony with their environment, will in some way contribute to enriching what, if we understand it well, we could call, using your words, the cultural heritage of the community. By necessary we would understand obligatory. You do, replied the voice, but we do not, since every child, at all times, has within his reach the example of those who help him to form himself. In other words, he guides others by always giving the example. That is the key. You cannot ask anyone for anything if you are not first willing to give everything you can give. Do you understand? I suppose that sports must play an important role in the lives of your children. Good. Sports are important for everyone, for the little ones and for the big ones. It is something that is part of our daily experiences. And what kind of sport do you practice? You yourself will be able to see some practiced later. But we anticipate that the attitude with which we practice sports has nothing to do with the one that dominates on Earth. The notion of competitiveness does not enter into our lives at all. We practice the sport that best suits our personality, our physiological needs, and for our enjoyment and fun. I immediately realized that I had gotten myself into quite a mess, because what could I say to him, in relation to our sports and to the sportsmen of Earth? I found myself with another of our subjects completely distorted. Starting with the Olympic maxim of Baron de Coubertin, the important thing is to participate. Now, both for the practitioners and for the fans of any sport, the important thing is to win. Whatever it may be, bribing left and right, even threatening violence or the kidnapping of prominent players, or death, as happened to the Swedish tennis player Borg in America, with brutality by the bucketful, shouting, yelling, insulting, blaspheming, attacking the moderators or directors of the game, hitting them and sometimes even trying to lynch them. And from the collective, team, results we move on to the cruel obsession with individual records, to achieve which the selected athletes are subjected to a lifestyle of authentic slaves of sport. Well, in short, all this can be called anything but sport. In any case, it is another palpable example of our degeneration. In other words, in this matter we could not give the slightest lesson to other civilized communities. I remained silent for a while and then I came up with another topic. Well, we still have to deal with free love. Well, that, in essence, is the result of the same childhood education. Children, from a very young age, are given the doors of knowledge wide open, without blinkers of any kind, and they are taught that in our communities no one is the owner or proprietor of anything or anyone. And that, therefore, no one, in any field, can dominate anyone or exercise power over anything. So procreation would be an almost mechanical act? Which is what the Catholic Church has always advocated. Because, since love or affection, or whatever it is that unites the couple in your world, seems to be something so fleeting and so fickle at the same time. Not at all, my friend. Couples are formed because there is an affinity that does not need to be described. Two beings are attracted to each other because some coincidence is evident between them that brings them closer and incites them to become intimate and to culminate the rapprochement as they best feel and understand it. The sexual act that can determine procreation, if they were shit, will have been propitiated by other previous acts of setting the scene, by which the way is taken, or not, to that union. This may seem complex, but in reality it is not. At least for us who, as you can see, always act spontaneously and naturally. This last stretch of the path, 70 to 80 meters long, is the one I walked twice. The second time was after the sea of multicolored light had exploded in the sky and through the trees in the background, where the path turns to the left. This is the clearing where the extraterrestrial spaceship was perched, about 50 to 75 meters in diameter and 10 to 15 meters high. Death. Will it always be something irreversible? The first long silence of the night fell here. As if they guessed that I needed to concentrate in order to continue asking questions. And, in particular, the big question. Because, the truth is, that having conquered death was something so fantastic, so unexpected, so fabulous, that it exceeded everything that the human imagination, however fertile and exuberant it might be, would be capable of conceiving. I remained looking at them, one after the other, at the four of them on the opposite side of the table, trying to see beyond the vaporous halo that enveloped their bodies. As if trying to guess if, in reality, they were people of flesh and blood or perhaps mechanical dolls, or perhaps half and half.